never been trammelled with the unhallowed doctrines of sectarianism, nor suffered the withering blight of vice, but it is free, active, and noble, and it expands and is calculated to expand to understand all things. Jedediah M. Grant of the First Presidency expressed similar feelings. He said, "I would rather have a young man fill this office than an old man who is filled with the leaven of sectarianism. Give me a man who was raised by a Mormon father and a Mormon mother and raised up in the faith from his childhood." Nevertheless, within the next few years, the patriarch would be subjected to suspicion and negative comments by some members of the hierarchy. And before the turn of the century, outspoken criticism would reach a point where church leaders were suggesting John be released as patriarch. After reading scores of letters written by John and those addressed to him, as well as journals, it was difficult for me to understand this growing antagonism. One complaint, that he was not completely faithful in living the word of wisdom, could not explain fully the negative reactions, because he was certainly not alone among the general authorities in having such problems. Some enjoyed coffee, others liked something stronger, and John liked to indulge his taste for tobacco. Brigham Young himself had said of the word of wisdom, quote, "A forced abstinence was not making us free, but we should be under bondage with a yoke upon our necks," end of quote. Then there was John's reluctance to enter into plural marriage, for which he was also condemned in the more private circles of the meetings of the Twelve, but this in and of itself would not have warranted the degree of suspicion levelled at him for much of his life. The premise of this paper is that, first of all, John's resistance to plural marriage was linked in the minds of the general authorities with his close friendship with his cousin, Joseph Smith III, and other, quote, apostate relatives in the reorganized church. The reorganized not only condemned plural marriage, their leader was the son of the prophet Joseph Smith and claimed to be his heir. This immediate concern, however, has still to be seen within the context of a more fundamental problem. The uneasy relationship between the fifth patriarch and the church hierarchy was just one manifestation of the inherent challenge presented by this hereditary and initially private primal office. The difficulties of accommodating an hereditary office first became evident during the 1845 succession crisis in Nauvoo. And with the growth of the church after the exodus to Utah, such familial claims to office within an institutional framework were becoming even more of a problem. Despite John's long and loyal service to the church, his independence illuminated once again the incongruity of a lineal office, and he suffered censure because of that throughout his tenure. John Smith was the eldest son of Hiram Smith and Jerusha Barden, Hiram Smith's first wife. Jerusha died when John was 5 years old, and he was 11 years old when his father, Hiram Smith, was martyred with the prophet. John's cousin and friend, Joseph Smith III, son of Joseph and Emma, was also 11 years old when his father was killed along with Hiram. There was already a very strong bond between the two boys, and this tragedy only cemented it. They remained close friends throughout their lives, despite the fact that their paths divided. Joseph Smith III ultimately became president of the reorganized church, and John became patriarch of the Utah church. It was believed by many in 1844 that young Joseph would have succeeded his father as prophet and president had he been old enough, and there is little doubt that John would have become the next patriarch immediately, but both were too young. Brigham Young became acting president of the church to become president in 1847, and William Smith, brother of Joseph and Hiram, became church patriarch in 1845. William lasted barely 5 months before being excommunicated for aspiring to the presidency of the church. William wanted the same authority as that held by Hiram, who had been patriarch and associate president of the church. But Brigham Young insisted that William be subject to the 12, of which quorum William was already a member. The whole episode engendered a great deal of apprehension during the succession crisis, and William became the spectre that continued to haunt the office of patriarch in the years to come. Following William Smith's excommunication, Uncle John Smith, brother of Joseph Sr., was ordained patriarch to the church in 1847, and he certainly provided a sharp contrast to William. He gave the church a breathing space of peaceful accommodation in terms of the hierarchy's requirements during the establishment of the church in Utah. Meanwhile, after young John left Nauvoo for winter quarters on his way to the Salt Lake Valley, Joseph III remained in Nauvoo. John received a letter from his cousin, who brought up the subject of spiritual wifery, calling it an iniquity. But this frankness made little difference to their friendship, nor did it alter John's commitment to the Utah Church. But this continuing close friendship of the Smith cousins was to prove troubling to the church hierarchy. John married Helen Smith in 1853, and a year later, his great uncle, John Smith, the church's fourth patriarch, died, and young John was ordained to the office by Brigham Young in February 1855. The president said he conferred the blessing and authority of patriarch upon John, quote, instead of thy father, who would have conferred them on thee if he had been alive. And we confirm thee to be the first in the Church of Jesus Christ among the patriarchs to set apart and confirm other patriarchs. And we bless thee with all the keys belonging unto you from your father. At the following general conference, he was sustained as presiding patriarch of the church. John Smith was not as ambitious as his uncle William, yet neither was he as compliant as his great uncle John. Young John and his wife Helen were less than enthusiastic about plural marriage. Helen wrote to her missionary brother-in-law, Joseph F. Smith, in November 1856, saying, Brother Young told John to get another wife. A year later, John did marry Nancy Melissa Lemon, his only plural wife, and Helen again wrote to Joseph F. in the Sandwich Islands, Well, John has got another wife. Perhaps you know her. Her name is Melissa Lemons. Dear Joseph, it was a trial to me, but thank the Lord it is over with. I care not how many he gets now. The ice is broke, as the old saying goes. The more, the greater the glory. All of the girls is getting married in Utah from 10 to 18. If there is any left till they're 18, they are on the old maids list. Helen also wrote to her husband, who must have been somewhere in the Midwest. Talk about me apostatizing. God forgive me, for I am a Latter-day Saint. But the Lord knows that I am no polygamist, and with the help of the Lord, I will have nothing to do with it. Can you understand that? Helen reminds John that he wanted to know her mind, so he must not complain if she tells him. She adds, Report is that you're bringing a lady wife with you. I would advise her to leave a portion of her refinement on the plains, and it will not go hard with her when she gets here. May the Lord bless you and bring you home in safety, is the prayer of your wife as ever. Nearly 3 years later, when John was visiting relatives in Nauvoo, he received a letter from Helen warning him, quote, John, when you left, you said you would go away, and when you came back, I would be a better girl. For better or for worse, you will find me changed from a weak girl to a strong-minded woman that will have her rights, if there are any rights for women. Certainly, John's reluctance to enter into plural marriage and Helen's outspoken distaste for it must have disturbed Brigham Young, especially when John was in close touch with his apostate relatives in Nauvoo. John wrote to his half-brother, Joseph F., commenting on how well he was treated during a visit to Nauvoo, and he said, They all profess Mormonism except polygamy. He told of the excitement there about Joseph III, who they expected would take leadership of a branch of the reorganized church. John continued to correspond with his cousins and to exchange visits with them, and it's possible that this was the reason he was called to put his patriarchal duties on hold and serve a mission in Scandinavia in April 1862. The official explanation was that he was young and needed the experience. During his mission in Denmark was the self-appointed guardian of the missionaries' welfare. His missionary journal reveals his compassion and concern. Repeatedly, he tells of taking care of sick or injured elders. Of one, he says, "I acted as doctor and made him some ginger tea, soaked his feet and put him to bed." On another occasion, of doctoring a boil, of washing Jesse's head with brandy, of rubbing another's head which was very sore from severe pain or a sick headache. He visited the missionaries daily in hospital, and prior to the elder's hospitalization, John had rubbed Elder Sprague all over with ointment, and in the evening he gave Lindsay a good washing in a tub of hot water. He watched over their physical and spiritual welfare. But John missed his family very much, and on occasion would take care of the children of the Danish members, noting wistfully in his journal that they reminded him of his own little ones back home. The letters exchanged between Helen and John are extremely honest. They're very affectionate and often very touching. Most of the time he addresses her as ever dearest Helen. One time he told her, "Dear Helen, be not afraid to trust me. I think that I can look at a woman without lusting after her. If you think otherwise, you do not know me." Although he did write to his plural wife, he never referred to her as my wife, only as Melissa. One letter to Helen reveals some lingering feelings about John's capitulation to the practice of polygamy. "Well, Helen, I think I have written to you about 20 times since I left home, and I intend to write again every time I feel like it. As to Melissa, I've only written 2 or 3 times, but I intend to write again when I get ready and feel like it. You again advise me to get 2 more wives when I get home. Again, what do you mean? You say also that if I do get more wives, I will take them on your terms. If I am to understand this as it reads, I would suppose that you was going to hunt up 2 wives for me and to do all in your power for my good and for my comfort without a word of complaint. For this kind of offer, my thanks for your kindness. I know that your generous heart is ever ready to do me good, but for the present, allow me to say that I have wives enough." Their letters suggest a close that allowed for the airing of religious doubts, concerns about finances, personal and church-wise, and about the rearing of their children. In one of his letters, John tells his wife to make sure that the schoolteacher does not whip their son, Hiram. He says, "I say he must not be whipped. The old proverb says, spare the rod and spoil the child, but in this case I do not believe it. Hiram is the same that I was, and I was whipped until I was case-hardened, and it made me worse than I otherwise would have been." He doesn't say who did the whipping. But all his life, John was a man who chose to nurture rather than to chastise. Letters addressed to him reveal how deeply he was trusted, and they tell of the affection that was felt for him by friends and family alike. Even while on his mission, John continued to correspond with his family in Nauvoo, and this close relationship with those in the reorganized church was evidently a topic of conversation back in Utah. On January 2nd, 1864, John wrote to his half-brother, Joseph F. Smith, saying, "I'm glad you mentioned that it's been said that I am a Josephite, although it is no new thing to me, for Helen wrote the same as early as June 14th. But she didn't mention any name. If you hear anything more, please inform me, for it will be interesting to know what folks think of me so far away. As to what people choose to say about me, What they say will not make one hair neither black nor white. If I am released here and I should stop in Illinois, that is my own affair. And if I come home like an honest man, it will not change the case by Madame Rumor talking about it. John had written asking his brother to purchase 3 or 4 copies of Lucy Mack Smith's history to send to his Nauvoo cousins, but the book was not approved by Brigham Young, who deemed it, quote, utterly unreliable as a history, as it contains many falsehoods and mistakes. Young said, we do not wish such a book to be lying on our shelves, but to be taken up in after years and read by our children as true history. It is transmitting lies to posterity, and we know that the curse of God will rest upon everyone who keeps these books for their children to learn and believe in lies. Lucy's history was removed from circulation, but 40 years later it was published in 1902 with only minor corrections. By the way, we are indebted to Leonard Arrington for the republication of the original 1853 edition of Lucy's history. When John returned from his mission in Denmark, he continued his close association and religious debates with the reorganized members of his family. The late prophet's son Alexander stayed with John and Helen during a visit to Salt Lake and later wrote to the patriarch. He said, I am well aware that your position is such that you must needs act with great care, caution, and forethought, more particularly if you do not agree with those in more exalted position in that organization. John, I do not know how strongly you may be bonded in those secrets, oaths, and combinations that have been established in that organization to bind the members together in the absence of the true love and power of God, which should bind the children of God more firmly together than any covenants or oaths that man can invent. In the name of Israel's God, I ask you to give heed to the dictates of the Spirit of Almighty God and seek your true position ere it be too late. Understandably, perhaps, there was some apprehension on the part of the First Presidency and the 12 as they saw John entertaining the Nauvoo Smith as they were proselyting in Utah. And although John was fulfilling his calling as patriarch, his faithfulness was called into question. At a meeting of church leaders in 1875, the presidency and the 12 voted to drop John Smith from the patriarchal office and put in his place Joseph F. Smith. But during the day, John and Joseph F. Smith had seen President Young and pled very hard to try John another 6 months to see if he would magnify his calling any better than he'd done in the past. End of quote. Then in 1883, at a meeting of the School of the Prophets, Joseph F. Smith, then a counselor in the First Presidency, spoke of the importance of being an example in living the law of plural marriage and the word of wisdom. The minutes record, he referred to John Smith's absence from the school, said it was because, as he thought, John had not lived his religion. Therefore, he had not asked that John Smith be admitted to the school, though he held the position of patriarch to the church. He smoked, and although having 2 wives, he lived entirely with 1. It became a question to his mind if under the circumstance he was not mostly to belong to this school, was he worthy to be patriarch. He asked the brethren to use their influence that Brother John might become a man. At that same meeting, President John Taylor commented, we have no right to present any of our relations, children or friends, to any of these plans or to receive any ordinances of the church who are not worthy of their acts. Just the same as Brother Joseph F. expressed himself in regard to his brother John, who does not and has not lived to the privilege he might enjoy. The pressure to enter into plural marriage had increased despite the fact that manifesto was only a few years away. In 1884, Abram Cannon noted in his diary, at a priesthood meeting held in the evening after the hall was cleared of all those who were not worthy of being present, the strongest language in regard to plural marriage was used that I have ever heard. And among other things, it was stated that all men in positions who would not observe and fulfill that law should be removed from their places. But John Smith was not an institution man. He was a compassionate and free spirit. And despite his discomfort in terms of public speaking, his patriarchal blessings reveal an eloquent spirituality. He gave 20,659 blessings during his tenure, and he travelled many thousands of miles in all weathers on horseback to bestow those blessings. The suggestion that John could have done more to magnify his calling could not have been referring to the blessings themselves, nor to any unwillingness on his part to give them. Local patriarchs had been giving rise to some concern, however. In 1877, Apostle John Taylor had written to George Q. Cannon, saying, "The subject of the present condition of the patriarchs has lately been considered by us. It has appeared to several members of the quorum that they have noticed a spirit among some of the brethren ordained to this office to degrade it to a mere means of obtaining a livelihood. And to obtain more business, they had been travelling from door to door and underbidding each other in the price of blessings. This we all considered an evil that should be remedied as soon as possible." End of quote. The solution, suggested Elder Taylor, was to organize a quorum of patriarchs over which Brother John Smith, by virtue of his calling, will preside, and the members of which quorum he will direct their labors and operations as he shall be instructed by the councils of the apostles. End of quote. It is not known if and when such a quorum was organized while John was patriarch, although there is evidence that one existed at least until 1932, because there are records of patriarchs voting in quorums in solemn assemblies. False rumors lingered about John's loyalty to the church, however. In a letter to Joseph F. Smith, June 6, 1887, the patriarch said, "In regard to my being debarred the privileges of the temple, I have never heard of it. It's evident that all mischief makers are not dead yet." In another letter to his brother in exile, Joseph F. was a polygamist living underground, John defends himself from suggestions that he might be giving his brother away to those hunting polygamists. He tells Joseph F., quote, "I have heard other reports which give me to understand that I have enemies somewhere, but my informant will not tell me where they got their news. I'm satisfied that there has been an evil influence working against me for some time, and why this should be, I am unable to discern as yet." What hurt John most of all was being accused harshly by his brother, to whom he had been ever true, as he said, "as my heavenly Father knows, if he knows anything." Insofar as the word of wisdom was concerned, John was caught in the greater emphasis on this revelation as a commandment, as well as the changing values of the institution. A grandson of John's remembers John telling him that Heber C. Kimball had taught him how to chew tobacco, but as the word of wisdom became more strictly regarded, John, among others, including church leaders, found it difficult to adjust. There followed public condemnation of John by President Wilford Woodruff at General Conference. Woodruff said, "Here I see the presiding patriarch of the church close to me. If he can't keep the commandments of God, we'll have to get another patriarch of the church. If he cannot put away his tobacco and smoking, he'd better resign. If he thinks those things are of greater value than the Holy Spirit, Brother John Smith, you'd better resign, and we will get someone who will keep the commandments of God." End of quote. Yet Woodruff himself had earlier quoted Brigham Young's tolerance regarding the word of wisdom. And although several of the brethren in the church hierarchy were still struggling with the requirements of the word of wisdom as a commandment, Apostle Heber J. Grant joined in condemning John at that same conference. These criticisms were muted when in 1901 John's half-brother Joseph F. Smith became president of the church. For the second time in the church's history, two brothers occupied the positions of president and patriarch. Joseph F. unsettled the other apostles at the very beginning of his tenure by requesting that his brother, the patriarch, set him apart as president of the church. added to which, the president commented, and we did it strictly in accordance with the pattern the Lord has established in this church. By this time, according to John's grandson, the patriarch had overcome his problems with the word of wisdom. And of course, plural marriage had been outlawed by the government and officially discontinued by the church. So there was no apparent reason why President Smith should not promote the status of the patriarchal office. The president added the patriarch to the list of general authorities who were sustained as prophets, seers, and revelators. And he encouraged the patriarch to travel among the saints to give the office the primal position outlined in the Doctrine and Covenants. Joseph F. was less successful in his suggestion that John be sustained at conference immediately after the first presidency and before the 12, as had been the custom earlier. For the 12, this raised the spectre of the succession problem. So the change was not made. John continued to fulfill his obligations as patriarch even after the death of his wife Helen in 1909. He also kept in touch with his cousin Joseph Smith III, head of the reorganized church. John wrote to him that he was, quote, lonesome at times, and the idea of remarrying, I don't know what to say, for the one to fill Helen's place don't come along as yet, and to get a substitute would be difficult. We had been married 54 years, less 3 months, 22 days. John didn't mention Melissa, his plural wife, who was still living. In 1911, Joseph III wrote, Dear cousin, I would have liked in the past to have had a heart-to-heart talk with you in regard to polygamy or plural marriage, but I steadily refused to urge the matter upon your attention while visiting you with you in Salt Lake City because I did not wish to compromise you with your brethren by indulging in such conversation, echoes of which might have reached their ears. I had known by rumor that you had taken a polygamous wife, but that upon returning home from Illinois, upon one of your trips you made east, you at once severed the connection, refusing to acknowledge it any longer. I was satisfied that it was what you had heard upon that trip east that you based your action in regard to putting the polygamous wife away. In view of what had taken place in the abandonment of the dogma and practice of plural marriage, I sincerely congratulate you upon the wise, prompt, and decided course you pursued in freeing yourself. I commend you still. You could have made no appreciable headway against the dogma. It would only have involved you in an interminable quarrel with the church authorities, with no possible good results. 5 months later, John died after only 6 days' illness. He was 79 years of age. The obituary in the Deseret News was headed, Patriarch Smith Summoned Home, and it noted, beside the 5 children, Patriarch Smith is survived by his wife, Mrs. Melissa L. Smith, 27 grandchildren and 27 great-grandchildren. Although the announcement included the marriage of John to Helen, and the fact that she bore him 9 children, there was no mention of Helen Smith's death 2 years earlier. Nor did the report take into account the fact that John was not living with Melissa at the time of his death. Melissa had given birth to only 1 child in 1958, a son who died at the age of 9 years. The day after John Smith died, his eldest son, Hiram Fisher Smith, received a letter from a John MacDonald. The tribute summarizes John Smith's life, I believe. He said, Tongue cannot tell how I feel on the passing of your father. As you know, he was one of the best friends I ever had. I learned to love him from my boyhood. I found him to be one of the greatest men that ever lived. In this way, he had a good word for every man, woman, and child. And even those that had persecuted us, he spoke well of. He had flowing in his veins some of that noble blood that his master had when he said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. How often has he, when people complained, turned and given them a blessing? We all love him. We shall all miss him. There was nothing boasting about him. He was simply Patriarch John Smith. It seems to me it took his departure to have his name or picture in a paper, yet he held one of the greatest offices in the church. In studying the life of John Smith, it has seemed to me that his faults paled in significance compared with the virtues of unswerving loyalty to family and friends and to the church, and his compassion towards his fellow human beings. Yet the effect of those same virtues, as perceived by many church leaders, caused anxiety within a church which was struggling to achieve strength and stability as a growing institution. Looking at just some of the elements which led to this uneasy relationship between John Smith and the rest of the church hierarchy may provide some enlightenment. What may be less understandable, however, is the continuation of the concern or antagonism through succeeding generations, unless one becomes acquainted with the larger historical picture of the office. Studying the history of the presiding patriarchs enables one the inherent difficulty facing the leaders of the church, that of trying to accommodate an hereditary office within a growing institution. Institutions require control in terms of who will occupy an office if there is to be any degree of predictability and stability. John was caught in the middle of this dilemma. His lack of conformity, plus his loyalty to the disaffected members of his family, provided a focus for that disquiet. But we still have to look at the entire history of this office in order to place John in the larger context of institutional development. And that in itself is another paper. Thank you.
It's really an honor for me to be a part of this session and a pleasure to comment on this paper. I think it's probably not appropriate for the commentator to say this, but I have followed Irene's scholarship on this subject and have been really impressed with the work that she's been doing. And I also believe that this is a very important issue that tells us a lot about the 19th century church. I think there's a lot of things in here that we can that'll help us understand the broader church and the development of the church hierarchy. So saying that, and the other thing that I want to say too is that we're really lucky that Irene has access to Smith family material that has not been used before in scholarly research, and I think that makes it very important. What I would like to do is just ask some questions, and I'm sure this goes along with the idea of things that need to be studied but perhaps are not a part of this paper. I just have a few questions here that I'd like to discuss a little bit. First, I think one of the important issues in John Smith's life is that he was a general authority for so long. He was presiding patriarch for 57 years. During that time, the church changed a lot. And all of us have a difficult time in adjusting to changes. And perhaps some of us can adjust in changes in quiet. It seems like his issues were brought out into the open sometimes, even at General Conference. I assume that his lack of enthusiasm for plural marriage was disturbing earlier in the 1850s, 60s, and 70s, while his problems with the Word of Wisdom caused problems later as the church was trying to change the image of what a Mormon was. And as you all know, Heber J. Grant started very early making the word of wisdom as a very important signal about who Mormons were. As Irene pointed out, John Smith was not the only member of the church who had a problem making these changes. I know my own grandmother had a hard time when she was used to drinking coffee and Heber J. Grant would come and preach about the word of wisdom. It was very difficult to her since she had grown up in the church and didn't know that hadn't been taught that earlier. Second, I'm very interested in the relationship between John and his second wife. Perhaps there are not the sources to study this relationship, but it is interesting to note that John was a polygamist most of his life. And so even though he was not enthusiastic about polygamy, he had a plural wife very early and throughout his whole life. So perhaps the key to this idea that he wasn't enthusiastic about polygamy comes in the Joseph F. Smith quote, which says that he entirely lived with his first wife. I would be interested to know about the second wife and to know how she handled that. I think his reluctance to enter plural marriage would be duplicated many times by other men who were members of the church during this time. But the way he handled that, by completely severing the relationship with the plural wife, if that's true, if Joseph Smith III is correct and when he writes that he gave up his plural wife, I think that is perhaps makes him unique in the other men who had entered plural marriage reluctantly. Also, I'm interested to know why Melissa put up with this. In a society where divorce was very easy to come by, particularly in this situation, why she continued to have this marriage. Apparently she didn't marry anybody else or didn't leave the relationship. Anyway, to me that is very very interesting and very important. And the third thing, the relationship between these two brothers, I think are something that is just very interesting. Apparently, at different times, Joseph F. Smith was very supportive of his brother John, talked to Brigham Young, convinced Brigham Young to keep John as the presiding patriarch. Other times, he could be very critical of John, as in the School of the Prophets, telling the brethren there that he wasn't worthy and wasn't living his religion. And yet, at the end of when he was president of the church, he is the one who increased his visibility and changed went through the process of changing the importance of the patriarchal office. So to me, this relationship between these two boys, these brothers, though they were just half-brothers, had different mothers, they had been raised together and apparently had a close relationship, is just very interesting. Often these things that are quoted as the hierarchy, talking about John Smith, really comes from his brother, which to me, I think, makes a different kind of statement. And so the relationship, this family relationship, I think is interesting, and it, apparently there are letters that could be analyzed on how that works, how that worked. The little part where that Irene has in there about the criticism of the patriarch in using the money they get for giving patriarchal blessings to obtain a livelihood is interesting to me, and I was wondering if this was a criticism they felt of John in the time when the general authorities did not have a way of organized way of compensating the general authorities. Would this be something that he had a special privilege of? He could collect money from his office, whereas the others couldn't. I'm not sure about that. I just thought that was interesting. And of course, I think one of the things that is the most interesting about this paper is how Joseph F. Smith viewed the office of patriarch, having his brother set him apart and saying that this is the way it should be, sustaining the patriarch as a prophet, seer, and revelator, and wanting to move the order of sustaining so that the patriarch would be sustained next to the president of the church. To me, and Irene recognizes this, this was probably very, very threatening to the other general authorities and the authority of the apostles that many of the men probably remembered had been fought out over the years who had the authority in the church, and the apostles had been able to exert their authority, and here this variant, I'm sure, was threatening to them. So I think what I want to say is that I think that's a very important thing in this whole relationship, and what that did to the concept of the patriarch later on after John's death, and how that had to work out in his grandson and great-grandson, I think is very important. I feel like that we need to pay attention, as if we want to understand the hierarchy and understand the 19th century church, we need to pay attention to this scholarship about the presiding patriarch. I know you probably have questions of Irene, so I will sit down now.
I'd just like to answer those things I can answer. We have tried to find out about Melissa and drawn a blank. If anyone else knows anything about Melissa, we'd be very grateful. We do know that she was still termed his wife when John Smith died. Incidentally, she was given financial support from the church. We get that from a letter. John, along with other general authorities, received financial support. And in that letter from Wilfred Woodruff, he mentions that John is appealing for some more money. And the president said, "We already give Melissa something as well as you." So she wasn't left high and dry, in other words. But we can't find anything out about her other than the fact that her son died. And it's very interesting, Jeff. I wish we could know more about it. I think that the relationship between F and John is interesting, and the differences of opinion they had, I think, largely were to... because Joseph F. was a polygamist and John Smith was so anti-polygamy, that was one thing. But there are letters that were exchanged between them that showed, just like all brothers, they had differences on other things. There was some arguing about property. There were, you know, various things. But this polygamy thing must have been a real hard thing for brothers who were so totally opposed in their views. It must have been very difficult. I can't think of anything else that I could add to that, but we are aware of Melissa and anybody who moved
the office. The question is about the discontinuation of the office, I mean.
It goes way back to 1845, 5. John Taylor, in arguing about the office of patriarch, and he was trying to put William back in his place, actually, when he did, he put an article in Times and Seasons in which he said that that if in the future there were enough patriarch, then the patriarch of the church would, by virtue of his office, preside over them. So it dates back from then. And it carried on, that presiding over local patriarchs, until Hiram G. Smith, before the 10-year hiatus. After Hiram G. Smith died, and he was the grandson of John, and he did preside very, very clearly, preside over the patriarchs. After that, that was deemed no longer necessary, and that the first of all, the Quorum of the Twelve would preside over the patriarchs, and then after that, the stake president of the stake would preside. But what it did was leave patriarchs kind of hanging singly without a base. Like most priesthood offices have a quorum, the patriarchs didn't from 1842 onwards. And that was your last point, was the big is the big question. And maybe Gary Smith and I have just finished a book analysing that very question, and maybe out next year. It's finished. I think all three of them. I think he was Helen and John Smith had a wonderful relationship. Very honest. They argued. It just was a very sound relationship. And I don't think he liked the idea of anything coming between that, and Helen certainly didn't. But I also do think that his very close friendship with Joseph Smith III had a part to play too. They really cared about each other. They'd been children together. They'd been through a terrible, traumatic experience together. And I admire John for his loyalty to his family. There's a letter from Don Carlos's daughter, by the way, Josephine, who became the first poet laureate of California, by the way, that is very touching. She writes to John and says that he's the only one that she was quite bitter about the church, but she said he was the only one that she could open her heart to. And I think that says a lot about John. So he was very close to his family. Well, I think it started actually. Well, first of all, in the Doctrine and Covenants, when Joseph Smith was enumerating the offices of the priesthood and whatnot, he put the patriarch first, even before the president. But after that, Uncle John Smith was always sustained immediately after the first presidency, and then it changed. So it had been done. I think that sustaining in conference, I think probably it was first done with John, Uncle John Smith. Not so far as I know. I've been through general conferences and I can't find any record of that happening. No, I don't think so. He asked it was John ever sustained before the first presidency. I don't think so. No, I didn't. Will you repeat that? Oh, it's a different Melissa, is it? Oh, I was just thinking then we'd got a breakthrough. What puzzles me about that reference in Helen's letter, she said that John was bringing a wife across the plains. And I don't know where she came from, why he would be bringing her across the plain. So I wish it had been so, Harriet. We just don't have a clue about her. No, the question was, did I find any evidence other than the letter when just before John died that Joseph had persuaded him against polygamy? No. In fact, in that letter, he says deliberately, I have not done that because it would have caused problems for you. But I don't doubt that other members of his family did influence him to some extent. But I think he was a willing listener. You know, I don't think he liked the idea of polygamy at all. And the letters between John and Helen, and we have a lot of them, suggest why, too. It would be very... Their relationship was definitely a love relationship and a very close and honest one. And I think that some of the marriages, the plural marriages, were not that kind of marriage. At least some of the reading I've done suggests that they were... Some of the wives were closer than the wives with the husbands. And so I don't know. Is that so, Brother Arrington? Don't you think that some of them were... But this is quite unique. I quite fell in love with them, to be honest. Of all the patriarchs, I just really admired John for his loyalty to his family, for his real compassionate service for the missionaries. He sewed for them. He did sewing and repairing and took care of them. And that was beyond the call of duty. Incidentally, while he was in Denmark, the word of wisdom was almost totally ignored by the missionaries. They used to go and drink beer. They'd go to the dance halls on Sunday. They'd do all kinds of things. But strangely enough, John did come down on those that smoked, which is ironic. He asked what the source was for the statement about the school of the in the school of the prophets, where they came down on John for not living polygamy, and also where were there any other indications that people were removed from office. I really don't know the answer to the last one; that was beyond my horizon. But as far as the source, I got it second hand. It was from a quite obscure book by Merle Grafham, in which she quotes from he quotes from the is it a he or a she do you know anyway they quote whoever it was quotes from the minutes of the School of the Prophets, and I don't know how they got hold of them, but it's verbatim, and it's borne out by other public announcements. I was trying to imagine what it would be like to hear somebody in General Conference today criticize another member of the hierarchy for some lack of faith or whatever. It would be much more interesting, I think. But they did in those days. I know that Joseph Smith Sr. was actually dragged from the stand by somebody who objected to something he said. So things were much more dramatic in the 19th century than they are today. Yes? How did John stay in for all those 57 years when there was so much criticism against him? Well, in the first place, it was a hereditary office. It was lineal. It was one of those things they could have and they did try to take him out of the office because he wasn't living the word of wisdom and he wasn't living polygamy and so on. But it was a very dicey thing to do, to take someone when church history and the Doctrine and Covenants says that this is a primal office. And this, in fact, Brigham Young said in 1847 that this office, that they were going to organize the church according to the original pattern that was with a president and a patriarch and 12 apostles, lest the devil take advantage of us. And so it was a very important office, and they didn't want to deal lightly with it in those days. Yes? Well, there was an institutionalization, and Brother Arrington had written an article a long time ago about the kind of changes that occurred. And Brigham Young was probably an organizing genius. And maybe if Brigham Young hadn't taken over, maybe there wouldn't be a church. because the Smith era was a charismatic era, which is very unstable. And it's interesting to note that while the Smiths were in the hierarchy, the office of patriarch remained. And when they were no longer in the hierarchy, then it slowly eroded. The first one was in 1837, and it was Isaac Morley in Kirtland. And then, bit by bit, there were others. But Isaac Morley was the first one. And there are papers written about Isaac Morley. And thank you.
Thank you, Irene and Jeff.